Throughout the year, we drink NC wine, cider, and mead. Whether you join us for an event, plan a visit to your local winery, cidery, or meadery, or enjoy a meal at your favorite restaurant perfectly paired with NC wine, anytime is a great time to get out and give love to your local maker. To plan your trip, download the NC Wine app or visit ncwine.org.
Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Matt. We're the NC Wine Guys. Welcome to Cork Talk.
This episode is the second part of a conversation with the crew from Parker Bend's Vineyard.
Wine Class of the Wine Mouths is back. Join us as they take us through the next chapter in the history of wine. This episode is made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. You can learn more about the council by going to their website, ncwine.org.
So sit back, pour a glass, and listen to part two.
All right, so we are back. So let's talk a little bit about, let's first start with the wines, because, you know, that's why we're here. So let's talk about a little bit about the wines that you're actually making from the grapes that you're getting from this excellent site.
I would say one of the biggest things that I first learned when I arrived and kind of saw what Bob and Karen had in barrel and in the bottle was that they wanted a diverse spread of wine style. So there wasn't anything that was hardline to one direction or another, one customer or another, one price point or another. It was more so that with the vineyard acreage that's had, what are we going to make that's the best that our customers enjoy drinking? And I definitely had some notions as far as what you're producing in volume and how that relates to what you produce that you think is maybe the more unique wine. And when you make the most unique thing at the largest volume, sometimes that equation does not work out for you. And the brands themselves, where we're showing a varietal on the label, those are the ones that we're probably the most enthusiastic about producing. They could also be the ones that we're producing the smallest volumes of. And when you get in behind some of the more fanciful names, those are wines that we're trying to get a larger taste profile or a larger palate as far as customer basis goes. And there is a good chance that there's a blend to it. There's a good chance that the varietals might be even unconventional for what you might put together. But that's really where the brand is that I've kind of tried to take what Bob and Karen already had and build upon that. I think the story that I've always enjoyed the most is Bob's appreciation for a wine that gave him a creative label nomenclature to refer to something as a soft red wine.
Yeah.
And it all started with his tasting of something that was one of the largest selling brands in the United States. And it was labeled as a soft red wine. And I, at one time, had worked in wine sales, and I can say with confidence that that's a term that you would look at and believe that it has definition, but it really doesn't have a definition. It's only up for interpretation by the drinker.
Kind of fluffy.
It is kind of fluffy.
Yeah.
And I think the idea that you're going to take something that's so ambiguous and try and push it back to a winery, and that winery say, all right, well, I can do that. It's like, well, how do you do that in air quotes? And I've very much sought working with some of the wines that we've made here to try and actually fit that. And one thing that we've sort of shifted and one thing that I've found success with is actually earlier releases on certain varietals. The Chamberson in our Peerage Red, I think it's at its best within a year of vintage. And I think more often than not, I believe that that grape can kind of lose its magic when you leave it in the barrel for too long.
Right.
So when I have to tell you what soft red wine means to me, it's the idea that you've got to find that on the palate in the cellar and then figure out how to actually pick that out of the winery and get it in the bottle. That to me is probably my biggest interpretation of how we've kind of pushed on certain wines and wine styles. And again, it's working with what we get from vintage to vintage and what this vineyard provides for us. But I think the future of what we're working on is we still have had a hard work ethic towards trying to build out red wines. You know, red wines are something that I think are the most difficult style to make in North Carolina. I'll be pretty broad about that.
It's the unicorn.
Yeah.
The big red wine.
I think the whole East Coast.
Yeah. When you're dealing with a temperate climate, you cannot just unplug the water supply and have all your grapes desiccate and your sugars go up and all your phenolics just reach a magic ripeness. And a lot of times those are the best components in wines out of a Mediterranean climate. So what can we do to get behind the lively characteristics, the fresh fruit characteristics, maybe the mild tannins, and make a red wine that we're still really excited about, a wine that we can grow really well, but that also relates to our customer. So that's where I think that's where we are today, and I think that's where we are as it relates to trying to make some decisions going forward with this vineyard site and what varietals are grown here.
Well, we built it out you're the one that's always brought up the idea of the pyramid, so to speak, and it applies to let's call it labels to start with, right? So like that Lulu brand, if it can, you know, air quotes, the P Ridge brand, air quotes. Those are like the approachable wines that we bring to the table every year. I think, you know, my grandmother's up there calling Lulu Wines porch pounders. I mean, that's who we are. But yeah, these wines are just meant to be, you know, Justin's always described them as drinking wines, not thinking wines. And we try to like base this on, we're trying to make something for everyone. And it's actually really interesting because I've never necessarily heard that perspective from you, in the sense that even when you got here and you started sniffing around inside of barrels, you could already kind of tell that they wanted that diversity to the wine portfolio. And I'm happy to say years later that, I mean, yeah, I feel that way now. I don't know if I just got, if I just assimilated into what.
Well, you know, the soft word that Justin mentioned, I just thought soft took it from, because I like dry wines. I did anyhow. Now I've been North Carolina-ized, and I like a more fruit-forward wine. But I used to like the dry Bordeaux wines, which I don't care for as much as I used to. I like the more fruit-forward wines, and I think it's a soft, and that's why I thought the word soft. I like that. But I do love, you know, to me, the wines, we all got used to drinking wines from California. You guys are too young to remember, but I remember when you used to buy these wines out there, Inglenook and Mad Dog and all these, and the ones prior to them, and they were $2 for a gallon. I mean, it was a different world. It was just a world full of alcohol with a lot of young people getting bombed. But then California elevated their wineries to what they are today. They're some of the best in the world. But they have their style. And their style is different, actually, than a lot of places in the world. And I think North Carolina and the entire East Coast has to come out with their style of wine, which we have, because this is the wines we make. You have to make what the terroir gives you. And this is what we're making. And people, as they grow used to it, will enjoy the wines from this area maybe even more than the wines from that area, because it's all what you get used to. When you're a kid, you start eating a certain thing, you enjoy it, and you enjoy it your whole life. We started young drinking the wines of California, and we got used to them. But now people are getting used to drinking the East Coast wines for the last 20 years, and they're getting used to them. And I can see it. We get orders on Vino Shipper from different parts of the country. I mean, who would have thought years ago people would have been going to Vino Shipper and ordered wines from North Carolina? I mean, of course, North Carolina was not known as a wine-producing state. Today it is, along with Virginia and New York, Northern Georgia.
The most diverse.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And also the idea that you're trying to bring in a your generation, as you're saying, there's a difference in age, right?
So imagine
the presence of mind of somebody who's coming into a business like the wine business where the majority of the stakeholders are all older than you. And you're going to come in and either try to fit in or find your own way. The harder thing is finding your own way.
But that's the good thing.
And that's, I really think that at this point in the North Carolina wine industry, I think that there's, and I'll give the shameless plug that Bob has given so much support to the idea that young people in the industry should spend time together to learn about what each other's trials and tribulations are and then try and grow off of that. And we've done that. In the past year, we have spent time and we've got a small group that we're hosting a week from today to sit down and taste.
Winemakers.
Yeah, that's winemakers, cool. Vineyard, everybody that has their hand in trying to kind of find the way is welcome to sit down in our little group. And the deal is that when you come to those meetings, it's you have to come into it and not think that you're like showing off your best.
Yeah, leave your ego at the door.
For sure.
And bring your worst one.
And I have
the one you need the most help with.
And I have done that. And every time I find that the best part of it is that I get feedback from my colleagues at the same level. And again, that to me is finding our way. And that's been a very it's kind of an emotional thing. It's one of those items that the number of times I've been, you know, you go to an event and you pour a glass of wine for somebody and whether they love it or hate it, it's like, you know, you could have literally, you know, spilled blood trying to do the work and broken your back to make it all happen. And they're just like, oh, it's not that good.
It's not my thing.
And at the end of the day, I think that I got not like a resilience to that, but I had seen people do that day in and day out at the sales floor at a wine shop. And so I knew that that was just human nature. It's for me a matter of finding a way to kind of connect with someone still. There's a way to connect with someone. It's not that black and white.
Come by here on a Saturday or a Sunday, bud. You'll see plenty of people
connecting with
it.
That's right. That's why I like to visit on a Friday. There's less competition.
So one thing we've kind of touched around a little bit too is you know, what is the brand of Parker Vins? If you had to think back about it, like the marketing aspect of it, how would you say this is who we are?
Yeah. That's a very good question. That's a great question. That's a question we have to constantly ask ourselves. Who are we and what are we and how do we project it to the general market? And to my thinking, we haven't got there yet.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe again, you might be too close to it to see it. For me, wine production is 1A and 1B. I mean, what we grow and what we make has to rule the roost, so to speak. Because no matter how awesome the environment, no matter how great your customer service, all the things that we believe we excel at, it doesn't matter at the end of the day if your product sucks. So I feel like we've gotten to the point now where, or at least I have, and these are the weird conversations I have with myself. That
is that on the tractor?
Yep, absolutely.
Tractor time.
In the truck and the ride in and the ride home, laying in my bed at night. But yeah, we're producing wines we're proud to serve and that we, like Justin said, put your blood, sweat, tears, and back into. All the while doing it in an environment that I feel like, you know, I've been to plenty of wineries around the state here. Unfortunately, I haven't been to a ton of them on a Saturday or a Sunday, but I walk into our place, I see the people's faces, I see them when they leave and they're bringing back friends. And we've made this environment that is extremely comfortable. It is extremely relatable. It is extremely comfortable. If I didn't already say that, let's say it three times, comfortable. We're trying to have fun. I said it earlier. We don't want to take the fun out of wine. We also don't want to be a bar, but I'd say this with pride. You know, we're probably the closest to it in the state because we have promoted this environment where people feel like a watering hole. People come around. They want to stay all day. We encourage them to do that. Come hang out. Spend the day with us. Bring your children. We are a family establishment. We want families.
That's why we have the animals, so the children can interact with them.
We have farm animals. bring your puppies, bring your family, bring a blanket and a picnic. I mean, yes, we have a kitchen, but if you want to have a picnic on the grounds, do that. You know, and I guess that's not unconventional, but we pride ourselves in customer service and the quality of the wines more than anything. I think we deliver on both stages.
Yeah, but that's all true what you say, but it's still, it's not the brand. I mean, the brand. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. It is the brand, but I think we need to. To me, I'm going back to the road sign where you see something and that's the brand identification. I guess, well, there's maybe a difference. There's brand statement. Identification and what the identification stands for.
Yeah.
Okay, I get that.
If you wanted to keep it in three short words. Great wine, fun times, better people, man. There you go. Put it on the table.
It's time to get up for Wine Class with Wine Mouths. Jesse and Jessica, welcome back.
Thank you.
I think last time we trekked through the 1700s, which was the 18th century?
Yes.
So we're moving to the 1800s, the 19th century
you
this
got
time?
It, which oh, is still good. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Just don't make me do the subtraction like you did last time. I can do addition fine, but subtraction.
Yeah.
And we'll just get through part one. We're not going to make it through all of it.
So we're
going to
do
tonight.
50-ish years, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Things are heating up. We are ramping up in a big way.
Okay. And with all the revolutions last century, who knew?
Who exactly. knew? So here's a little context for what is going to be going on in the 1800s. In the actual year 1800, like 1800, Napoleon Bonaparte, I'm sure you've heard of him, he conquered Italy, right? So following the French Revolution, he conquered Italy single-handedly. This is some revisionist history. But he and his forces conquered Italy and firmly established Napoleon as the first consul in France. So that's important. Back in the States, we get in 1803 the Louisiana Purchase happening. So another important thing. And, you know, everyone's America's favorite bad guy, good guy, whatever you want to call him, Alexander Hamilton. He and Aaron Burr's duel happened in 1804. So that's bringing us into this. In 1812, we get the War of 1812.
Which lasted until?
I have no idea, but I think 1814? It was actually, yeah, it was like longer than that. I don't know why some wars get really cool names and some just get War of 1812, but that's not my job, so. And also in 1821, Mexico gained independence from Spain. So that's important.
So now we're moving, and we have a guy, Antoine Chaptal. So I don't know if that last name rings any bells, but maybe by the end of the story, you'll figure that out. But so Chaptal became Napoleon's interior minister, but he was also a chemist. Hmm. So at this time, the vineyards of France were in disarray. Remember, we left off last time. There's revolutions. There's wars. So the vineyards of France are not in a good shape. They were devastated by neglect, bad weather, overproduction, revolution. But Chaptal decided that he thought there was an answer to this. So he was sure that if winemakers could understand the chemistry of wine, figure out the laws of fermentation, the effects of this climate and soil, that they could take control and they could apply science to winemaking and improve the quality of wine. So one of his ideas to provide stability to wine was to give it a good alcohol level. Because alcohol, you need a good alcohol level to combat bacteria and all the things that can grow in wine, not only to make it taste good, but he wanted to do this. And so he decided to add sugar to the grape juice before fermentation.
Well, that's where we get the term.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
For better quality and stability. So, unfortunately, the majority of the wine growers in France saw it as a way to legitimize overproduction and not care for quality. He kind of gave folks like an easy pass, right? But
which is not very French.
No, it's not.
No.
But today, capitalization is,
capitalization.
Yes, is still used. So we can thank Jean-Antoine Chaptal for this. But the main thing, I mean, he did that, right? But he wrote something called the
Traité théorique et pratique sur la culture de la vigne.
And so this
or something like that.
So this first appeared in 1801, and this put science, chemistry, and the need to control like the nature of how you grow your grapes and winemaking at the heart to understanding wine. So he's like giving folks the science behind wine. And it's one of the first books out there for wine at this time that had science behind the heart of wine.
Hmm. And this does seem very French and very like terroir and rules and
exactly
tradition and
so
science as well.
Let's remember Chaptal, not for chapelization, but for putting science to wine.
And I couldn't have said the title of his book better myself.
Literally.
So apparently the rest of it was avec l'art de faire le vin, les eaux de vie, esprit de vin, vigneré simple et composé. So it basically meant the art of making wine, the water of life, the spirit of wine, simple vinegars and composé. So compositions, I guess.
You could have shortened that title.
Yeah. It was a long title apparently, so.
Did they have the Dewey Decimal System back then?
Probably be in the 900s, maybe? I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway, carry on with the 1800s.
So we are actually going to move to the new world now. And we are going to talk about the settling of Australia. So it's really hard to have these hard, fast rules about time and history. Because our wine history of Australia actually technically begins in the 1700s. I'm really sorry because we could have talked about this last time. But in 1770, there was a guy named Captain James Cook. Thank God for these British names. The easy part. But he reached Botany Bay and sailed to Cape York, and he claimed the coast for Great Britain. And in 1788, a group of soldiers, settlers, and everyone's favorite, convicts, arrived to form a penal colony. Because if you've got criminals, you want to get them as far away as possible. So the colony was very isolated, obviously, and they needed to become self-sufficient as quickly as possible. So along with other food crops, they planted grapes. Unfortunately, they did not do well in the humid climate of the Sydney Harbor. By 1791, again, sorry, we're last century, but Arthur Phillip, who was the governor of the settlement there, had established a small vineyard about 12 miles inland from the Sydney Harbor. And here, the weather was a lot drier and vines were way more successful because it was not so humid. Because we know in North Carolina, for example, where we are, the humidity can be a big problem. So a little more further inland, things are looking better for them. One of the first commercial grape growers in Australia was a guy named John MacArthur. Okay,
we're there.
Just a hop, skip, and a jump. But he was famously known, actually, for being the first person to import Merino sheep to Australia. And these sheep would become the mainstay of the nation's wool industry, Australia's first major agricultural export, way more important than grapes at this time. In 1805, John MacArthur was granted 2,000 acres of grazing land outside Sydney. And 10 years later, 1815, he began an 18-month-long journey through Europe, which I feel like would take a long time anyways because, like, you can just, like, drive. but he began an 18-month-long journey with his two sons, and their goal was to learn the craft of winemaking and obtain grape cuttings to bring back with them to Australia. So following that 18-month journey, by 1820, he'd established a 20-acre vineyard outside Sydney. And within the next 10 years, they were producing more than 20,000 gallons of wine a year.
Wow.
So that was a fruitful journey through Europe for him. Another important guy we have in Australia is a guy named Gregory Blackland. And he established a vineyard in 1818 and experimented with a lot of different grape varieties and other crops. And he was the first person to send wine from Australia back to Britain in 1822. Now, what do you know about that journey from Australia to Britain?
It's long.
And sea-based. So the wines had to be fortified. We knew at this point that wines would travel better if they're fortified. So wines were fortified with brandy to protect them from spoilage.
And in London, once those wines got back, they were awarded a silver medal in 1823. And in 1828, they won the gold. So thank you, fortified Australian wines.
Which we don't think of nowadays. They must have been lost to time.
Yeah. We also get a guy named James Busby, and this is a name you're going to want to remember. And in 1824, he immigrated to Australia, and then he traveled to France, like roundabout kind of way.
Right. I mean, Australians are really paying for their folks to travel the world.
I can't imagine this sea voyage. But so he traveled to France, and he was going to study grape growing and winemaking. He was given 2,000 acres in the Hunter River Valley, established what is now the most important wine region in Australia. He's also known as the one of Australia's pioneering winemakers and the father of the wine industry in Australia. So he immigrates to Australia, is there for a while, and then he travels to Europe to learn more about winemaking and to get cuttings of more than 500 different varieties of grapes. When he returned to Australia, he donated the majority of those cuttings to the government and established an experimental garden. And from these cuttings from Spain and France, he introduced Syrah and Grenache to the region, which are now really important grapes for Australia. And he wrote a lot of books on winemaking and grape growing in Australia, but he left the country in 1833. So he was only there for 9 years and did a lot of stuff. He was a busy guy.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like an overachiever.
Yeah. We would not have been friends. We also get two doctors, Dr. Lindemann and Dr. Penfold. And Dr. Lindemann, I don't know, are you familiar with these names?
I mean, Penfold, for sure.
Yeah. So Dr. Lindemann settled in the Hunter River Valley in 1841, and Dr. Penfold was in Adelaide in South Australia in 1844. Dr. Penfold actually brought vine cuttings with him on the boat from Europe. So, just like tending to his little grape
got
in a bag.
Got my luggage, got my bag of grape bags.
Got to keep it safe.
That's what you do back in the day.
Yeah, of course. You don't know what you're going to need in the new world. And he planted a vineyard as fast as he got there, and he was also establishing a medical practice. You know, in those days, like, wine was medicine, and medicine was wine, and all the things. So, it makes sense to me. Also in Australia, though, at the same time, we get three boatloads, literally boatloads.
Oh,
but literal boatloads of people, of German Silesians.
Were they sloshed?
They were sloshed. German. Yeah. Well, no, they were de-sloshed.
Oh, okay.
So they had no castle. They had no home. So Silesians. So Silesia is a historic region in Central Europe. It's one of those that's like, knows no borders exactly, or, you know, has been part of different countries throughout history, but it's mostly in Poland, but parts of it are in Germany and the Czech Republic. So these Silesians, who are de-sloshed, they arrived in South Africa in 1842, and they were religious refugees fleeing from the excesses of the King of Prussia, and they were trying to get to a place where they heard that they would have religious freedom and also land. Because what do you need when you want to go be free? You need land and places to, you know, plant stuff and grow and whatever. Oh, South Australia.
Yeah.
Did I say the wrong thing?
You did say South Africa. I'm like,
South Australia. Okay. Sorry. So let me back this up. I left out part of those words. So they arrived in South Australia in 1842. They had heard that there was religious freedom and land available. And the first families settled in the Barossa Valley, and they began to plant vineyards. And to this day, most of the old grape growers in Barossa are direct descendants of those first settlers, those Germans.
Hmm.
Yeah. Also another theme we've seen throughout history, like religious freedoms and people going out and doing stuff. So we're trying to kind of keep our discussion to the first half of the 1800s today, but we're going to jump over just a little bit past that. And in 1852 in Australia, not Austria.
Or Africa.
In 1852 in Australia, they discovered gold. I don't know who did it, but somebody did. Someone discovered gold. So the wine industry was starting to take off. Things were starting to happen. Unfortunately, due to the gold rush, that takes away all the possible labor that would have been devoted to wine, and moves that over to the gold rush instead. People are going for that.
However, it also brought in many new immigrants, and the population of Australia doubled to just over 1 million between 1850 and 1860. So, like, huge exponential growth in the 1800s in Australia. And over the second half of the 1800s, the wine business expanded slowly. So that was not the focus at this time. International and domestic tariffs discouraged the shipping of wine out of its home state. We also see a very active temperance movement in Australia, which kind of diminished the kind of demand and supply and all the things for wine. So not so good. All right. So we're going to talk about another new world country. And we'll come back to Australia in our next section in our next class about our next discussion of. But so in New Zealand was a British colony. And the British colony in New Zealand lasted from 1841 to 1907. So right at the tail end of our 1800s discussion today. And some important names to know. One is Reverend Samuel Marsden. And he was chaplain to New South Wales and was the driving force behind the establishment of an Anglican mission, missions in New Zealand in the early 19th century. His work helped build a relationship of trust, a positive thing, between the Anglicans and the Maori chiefs, and paved the way for the acceptance of an official crown presence in New Zealand. It seems a little bit different, like mm-hmm. that relationship and respect and trust, rather than just going in and here we are. But this guy, Samuel Marsden, planted the first vinifera vines on the North Island in 1819. We know this because he recorded it in his diary on the day he planted it.
Oh, nice of him.
Yeah. So, dear diary, he wrote. and he has a nice little passage about how New Zealand promises to be a very favorable to the vine, as far as I can judge. So he already can see the importance back in 1819 as he's introducing it. In 1836, we get a guy named James Busby.
What? Again?
What?
Yeah. And he, by way of Australia, settled in a place in New Zealand that starts with a W, Waitangi.
I don't know.
And he planted grapes and made New Zealand's very first wine. So thank you, James Busby, for coming all the way over here. However, the industry was very slow to develop, and it spread across the North Island in a very small scale. So things are moving slow. Yeah, so that's New Zealand.
And all right.
The New World in the early 1800s.
Yeah. We're going to hop back over, hit back into Europe. We're going to talk a little bit about Italy. So specifically in Barolo. So Barolo is talked about as Italy's leading wine. But what's the grape?
Sangiovese. Oh, no, Barolo. I'm sorry. Nebbiolo.
Nebbiolo, yes.
I was thinking Chianti.
That's okay. We've traveled the world. But Nebbiolo is an old grape. Some people think that Pliny the Elder wrote about it. Others say that its DNA threads all the way back to the ancient wines of Georgia. Anywho, in Barolo, it wasn't doing so well. So they had it planted in Barolo. And we have the politician Cavour, and he was a patriot who led the surge towards Italian unification. But he was not sure about Nebbiolo. So he decided to plant 12 acres of Pinot Noir because he wanted something like Burgundy. But Pinot Noir didn't grow well, couldn't create it. So he's bummed. So he consulted with another local landowner, the Marchesa di Barolo. She also enjoyed French wines, but she didn't like the wine when she came back. So these people had traveled to France. They loved it there. They wanted the wine when they came home. But Cavour hired a French winemaker to come and sort things out. So Louis Audard was actually from Champagne, but he was hired by the politician, but he was also hired by the Marchesa in 1843. So Audard found that Nebbiolo was cropped too heavily. It ripened late. It was picked, put in cellars that weren't clean. So it was going through fermentation erratically. So he decided to fix things. So Odar cut the yields, picked the grapes ripe, which now seems like common sense, right? cleaned the cellars, brought in new equipment, heated the fermentation to produce a full-flavored dry red wine, because before it was slightly spritzy and sweet and not good. So he made the first Barolo as we think of Barolo today.
Interesting.
But King Carol Alberto of Savoy liked Marchesa's new wine so much, he ordered a barrel for every day of the year, excluding Lent, of course.
Have to get something up for that. Yeah. So.
So yes, this we see in the 1800s, the starting, what we consider the modern day Barolo.
By a Frenchman.
By a Frenchman.
So we are reaching the middle point of the 1800s. And we're getting close to where we will stop. So we talked about this French guy in Italy and his importance. And so we're going to go back to France now. And imagine yourself in Bordeaux in 1855. Yeah, okay, so we're all there. Prior to this, the merchants of Bordeaux had been unofficially classifying properties in Bordeaux since the 1600s. So this was nothing new. But Bordeaux's wine development was built on trade. And they've been, you know, saying which properties are important and doing well and all the things way before the 1800s. And this site has been really important, even all the way back to Roman times. All right, so we've talked about how there's no hard and fast rules on dates and history, and they all kind of flow together. So we've imagined ourselves in Bordeaux in the 1800s, but this has been a really important time and place for wine all the way back to Roman times and before. And wine development has been built in Bordeaux, and merchants in Bordeaux have been unofficially classifying properties here since the 1600s, maybe even before. This hierarchy was developed, and the first classification occurred in 1647. Influenced by Dutch traders who were in the area. And they put Sauternes at the top here because it was the most expensive, had the highest prices. Now, they made classifications in the Bordeaux region in 1816, 1824, 1828, and 1848, but it was done by the Chamber of Commerce and wine brokers. So it was really all about money, not about quality. That money was the main driving factor here. And there was a hierarchy of 5 price levels. What was that for quality? Like, does price beget quality? Who knows? So in 1855, Napoleon III, the Emperor of France, decided to throw an universal exposition in Paris to represent the country's wines. The Syndicat of Courtiers was asked by the Chamber of Commerce to come up with a list of Grand Cru classes, or classified growths, and they kind of ranked these, and there have been very few changes since. So the idea of a chateau stems from this classification. As of the classification, only 5 estates called themselves chateaus, but by 1874, there were 700 chateaus, and by 1300 by 1893. So this gave people a way to note legitimacy and to also get higher prices. So higher prices, better quality. We'll leave the consumer to decide. That Bordeaux 1855 classification kind of set the stage for the modern French system of wine quality control.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that makes we're talking about food pairings.
Yeah. All right. So remember our guy Chaptal?
Mm, yes.
Me.
All the sugar. Yes.
So where else do you know that capitalizes wine?
Oh, there's lots of places.
I mean, of course, but like. I mean, we don't need to call anyone out or anything, but I'm just saying, like, here in North Carolina, it happens.
It does, yeah.
So North Carolina wine makes a very natural pairing with North Carolina food. So correct. What do you think with North Carolina?
Well, barbecue,
yeah,
of course.
Of course. So we think capitalized sweeter wines would pair nicely with North Carolina barbecue. Lexington style, of course.
Of course.
If there is any other kind of barbecue.
Well, says the girl from Davidson County. We like all barbecue. Just all FYI.
We'll do an episode on Eastern style another time.
I mean, it probably would work.
I mean, some muscadine wines, some Eastern style. Yeah. It's probably going to go.
True true, true.
Yeah.
So Barolo we talked about too. And this could pair nicely with a lot of heartier, meatier, gamier, richer things. Anything from just a charcuterie board to risotto, pasta, like mushroom heavy dishes, I think could be a nice pairing.
People say wild boar. I've never had it, but
no.
Could be interesting.
I know people say it. I'm like, are you going to back yourself up on this?
Yeah, really.
Give me some wild boar. So we also talked about New World countries, so Australia and New Zealand. So Australia, what do you think of?
Sharias.
We also, of course, think of those little sheep.
Oh, yeah. But they're probably not so tasty, but certain varieties of
them. Yeah, but a Shiraz.
Well, what's the little sheep?
Well, I'm not going to eat the... I'm not going to eat...
They're a little too fluffy,
baby,
right?
With yes. A Shiraz. But,
well, I'm gonna eat those
sheep. But... Shiraz and a lamb pairing would be nice.
Yes,
but this is sure. A bad segue because in Australia they do have these little things called baby doll lambs, and they're so cute and so little, and they're like bred to be shorter so they can just roam freely among the vines and just nibble their way and
eat everything but the grapes.
Yeah, they're so cute and little, and they're not for eating. And
they probably only eat like weeds and plants.
Yeah, right?
Certainly.
But that's helpful still.
Yeah, and they're adorable.
Yeah.
And so somebody in North Carolina should get baby doll
sheep.
Yes.
And they have these little ringlet curls, kind of. Yeah.
And then they need some chateau or some sloshes.
But I would not recommend a baby doll lamb Shiraz because that just seems cruel. And
I mean, unless you're like, you know,
like
having some
lamb yoga or
something. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In the vineyard with your Shiraz.
Mine with a yogurt sauce, perhaps.
Yeah, well, that
works. So New Zealand, of course, we can't talk about New Zealand without talking about...
Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
Which goes with anything.
Anything. Almost anything. But especially like herbaceous dishes, most of the things, anything spicy, flavorful, Thai food.
Hot summer day.
Food. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The best wine. We also talked about Bordeaux and the Bordeaux classification in 1855, setting the groundwork for the AOC system in France. So here we could do a lot of things. Roasted veggies, roasted duck, gamey, meaty, fatty things, lots of oil. I'm just picturing like, I don't know, steak frites.
Cassoulet.
Yeah. Like, French peasant food. Any of those things could be great. So, I don't know. Any other additions?
I'm hungry now.
I know. It's happening again. Never not hungry.
All right. Well, we look forward to the next half of the 1800s, which is the 19th century.
But we hear there's a scandal that's going to be talking about next time. So
all
stay
right.
tuned.
There are alligators. It is a cross-country romp.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Did I get away too
Way to set that up. Much?
There may be some embezzlement.
Light embezzlement.
Well, tune in next
Maybe,
time.
Maybe, it's going to be exciting.
Jessica, thank you very much.
Thanks
for having us.
You can find out more information about the Wine Mouths by going to their website, winemouths.com, or on Facebook and Instagram at Wine Mouths. That's WineMouths. And now, back to the show.
Well, you know what I like? I was going through some old videos because we're going to put out a couple of videos. And we got videos of like different Saturday, Sunday afternoons and the pig picking and all. And you see the family. Corey has just said, you see the families on the lawn. You see little kids playing with a ball. I mean, it all goes together. I mean, it's beautiful. Uh-oh, come over here.
We have a special guest joining us.
Yeah.
She's been mentioned many times during this conversation, but she's finally making an appearance.
Welcome to the conversation, Graham.
Oh, she has a check for us.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Parker Benz. Come on out and see us. We're a fun place, great wine, and good people.
She's the brand.
So she just answers
the
brand question.
Came up with the brand.
I think she just, it's funny, you said the exact, I said, yeah, great wine, or I said, great wines, good times, better people.
Okay, what were we talking about? Branding.
Oh, we're going to wait until Grimm's.
I think you resolved the branding question.
I think we're good on the branding.
Oh, was that the question?
You got it from Karen.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Are we going to use the Yellowstone brand?
Yeah. What else? So let's say looking back, so you've been at this for 14 years now, I think you said, right?
Okay.
So what's left the biggest impact on you over the years? Biggest impact.
Biggest impact? Wow. That's a very good question. I'd never thought of that. The biggest impact? Well, I would say just the growth that we went through. I mean, we went from where I remember we were making 200 cases of wine, and I'm thinking, wow. And then it went to 500, and now we're not at 3,000 yet, but we're knocking on the door. And I talked to Justin about this. I say, where should we go and call it quits? I mean, we don't want to get to be that big winery that just, we don't want to be a factory. We want to still keep that personal, artistic touch to the winemaking. So how many cases is that? And we're still debating that. Is it 3,000, 3,200, 2,900? We'll find it, and when we find it, we'll know that we're there. So that would, to me, that would be what I would think would be the biggest impact.
The biggest impact for me, I would say the nuance and learning to come to grips with how nuanced this thing is. I've always enjoyed black and white. I come from the military. But also how much has to go into the vineyard here, the winery side of it. You know, when I first was asked, I didn't volunteer, was asked to come and do this, I was excited because I was like, all right.
Volunteered.
Yeah, I challenged you in the first minute. However, you know, it was, all right, you're going to need to learn every corner of this business. And I've tried my absolute best to continue to make sure that the vineyard works as advertised and as good as it can be every year, while simultaneously just trying to learn something every day. And I'd say the two of the three people, in fact, the other one just left, that I've learned the most in this industry from, are two of them are sitting at the table with us now. And then via independent research, and you know, I didn't have the opportunity to go to school, but man, it has been like life changing learning this thing, and then you know, hopefully getting better at it each year, just because I've been surrounded with awesome people and you know, blood in some of it. But JT's a brother at this point, anyways, too. So that is definitely the biggest impact.
How about for you, Justin?
How can you follow that?
The only thing that I think would really define the impact that I have had, as I've had a chance to work with Bob and Karen, but also being in the North Carolina industry, because before I even worked with Bob and Karen, I knew of them. I saw them at conferences. There was always that educational backbone, and we still do have an educational backbone in the state for the industry. But what I would summarize that with is determination. So one of the biggest things that I think outlines the industry, and then as it boils down to Parker Benz, is that determination can produce good and bad results. And I think that one of the most important things in the determination of what Bob and Karen had was that they were planting a vineyard. They didn't know where it was going, but they very quickly realized that they needed to get focused on what the next step was. And as we brought more into the fold, being the fact that not only were we making the wine, but at one point, Bob had me trying to drive the tractor too and manage parts of the vineyard. And it was one of those things that I looked at and thought, we've got the energy, we've got the focus, but we're missing something. So for Corey to have come in right when he did, everything sort of just went to the next step. And that's not to say that it's just a back of house item. It's also to say that when we were doing all of this on the front of house, Corey's mom, Bob's daughter, Kelly, you know, her and Karen were spending so much time on the front of house, and it was time with customers, and it was time with suppliers, and it was time with people who came in and asked about, you know, what we're doing and what are we excited about and what are the plans that are in store for the future. And they would all kind of come back to the table and say, okay, so the bad side of determination is that you have to sit down and say, there are only so many things that we can push forward, and something's going to have to lose. And I think at the end of the day, we've tried really hard and had, I mean, I feel like we've had tough conversations over what do you choose? And then what do you get behind and have the enthusiasm and the excitement to say, all right, we made it to that mark. Like Bob said, where's the ceiling? Because, you know, at the end of the day, I am very fortunate to do what I do based on the fact that, you know, let's just boil it down to dollars and cents that Bob and Karen have invested in what's happening here. So if he just said, I think we should have a 10,000 case facility, well, then you sit down and you write out what that looks like.
It's the roadmap.
That's, yeah, then that's where we're going. But we've done it really in increments, and he's done it in increments that, by he, I mean Bob, in increments where he could find a footing pretty quick. So it wasn't ever a giant leap. And I think that's where it just comes back to trying to make sure that if you're going to push for that next level, that you're not going to do it and kind of go off the deep end. So determination for me, that's the most impactful part of the North Carolina wine business. And it exists here for sure at Parker Pins.
So before we wrap up though, there's one Bob story that I want to get to. So, and there's another wine that Bob had a hand in helping name. So can we talk about that one a minute?
Yeah.
Because that was pretty unique.
So. Yeah.
The traditional method sparkling wine?
Yeah, that would be it.
Yeah. So we had a...
Making fun of Bob Day.
No. It's just a story that everyone needs to hear.
Yeah.
You know, before you get to that, let me say, in the last thing Justin was saying about determination, he was talking about how the fruit would come in and he would make it. Justin is very polite and courteous, but he used to be a lot of times disappointed with the fruit that I would bring in. And Adolfo and I didn't get it exactly the way he wanted it all the time, but now he feels that Corey's bringing it better. And he got rid of me in growing the fruit.
Hey man, no, just dive in. I mean, he had a clean slate. Justin had a sponge that was saying, I know nothing, teach me everything. And, you know, and we jumped and dove with that. I mean, and I think that, you know, where we're going, again, like what he said, it's the leap of faith. We haven't made that leap of faith yet if we wanted to be the 10,000 case facility.
Well, wait a minute. We went from 3 to 10?
Well, listen, you got your goals, I got mine, so...
You know, you get this. Too big, and then it's not, you get, well what's
the
plus?
Do you think there's any factories, as you said, in the state right now? And you don't have to name them. In fact, I'd encourage you not to. But do you think there's a factory in the state?
No. Somebody, no, I'm just...
There's some room there. There's some people pushing out some pretty hefty cases.
All right, you know, all right. What am I going to say?
Nothing, but...
I'll be quiet.
We'll talk.
Hard for me to do, but I'll be quiet.
We'll talk.
Is this a first? Should we mark this down? Bob's going to be quiet?
Absolutely. Put it on the calendar.
But in building out that idea, there was a point where Bob had some enthusiasm over the idea of making sparkling wine. And when I was a student at Surrey, we made a lot of traditional method sparkling wine, and I had probably 60% of that kit in the back of my mind, but I was not totally set on where it was going to go as it related to what Bob wanted to do. So started to propose the idea, spend a little bit of time talking to other people in the industry who were doing it and specifically focusing on small scale. So one of the biggest issues that I think comes up, and this happened to me very early on, was just mentioning the idea that you're going to make sparkling wine to an equipment supplier. They're excited. I mean, it's like 10,000 for this, 10,000 for that. And I know that is not the way that we're going to kind of bring something up to start with. So had the whole, you know, base kit figured out, so to speak, But the one thing that was not even close to being figured out was what it was going to be called. And Bob was set on, and I had explained that it was going to be traditional method. Traditional method. Okay, so that would be how we, yeah, that would be how we say it in the States. Or if you were French, you would say method champenois. And Bob came into the winery one day and started asking, what are we going to do with the method chimp, chimp, chimp? And as I'm saying this, he was like rolling his hand like there's more to the word. And in my mind, I'm like, there is more to the word, but that's brilliant. The chimp. And so the method chimpanzee was born out of the idea that we sort of bootstrapped a project to make a sparkling rosé of Merlot, traditional method, and it stuck on an ism that came out of Bob's mouth, and it was one of those that as soon as it happened, I just looked across the overall spectrum of branding in, you know, their family and the wines that they'd already had on the list, and I saw that that was something that, as far out as it would sound, it fit. And I don't remember at which point I even felt like I was selling the idea, because again, like when it. Bob was looking at me saying method chimp chimp chimp, I'm going, a chimp, that's what it is.
And it's kind of like the onus of our place, right? That name, it's like making light of something that is otherwise serious, or
that's right,
people may perceive as serious.
That's right.
A bottle of bubbles, what could be more? So no, I think that one, the chimpanzee, for me, I tell everybody in the tasting room, you know, it's cute and funny on the label, but it's all business under the crown cap.
And
to piggyback on that, guys, I think that Justin and I have had this conversation so many times. The state, we could be doing so much more of it here.
Yeah.
And if there's more people that are interested in making sparkling wine, especially looking through the same lens as somebody like, say, Bob Binns, where, hey, you know, $50,000 startup is just not a thing. I mean, I would encourage him to reach out. I mean, we've always been open. And Justin, I know for sure, like, he can tell you how to do it with a 50-gallon drum for a disgorging booth. He can get you there without having to spend the bank account. And then, hey, find out if your customers enjoy it. But I think, as a grower, we can grow to 17 bricks with good acid every year here. It can be done every single year. To me, it's something that needs to be explored more.
And sparkling wine's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's a lot of work, though.
It is a ton of work.
Yeah, I'll be the first to admit that it is a ton of work. But then at the end of the day, to me, I don't know why, it's one of the most exciting wines to make.
Yeah.
It is one of the most exciting wines to make. Maybe it's that point where you take a still wine, and then the next time you start to interact with it, it's full of CO2 and carbonation and the perlage, and there's just this like magic in the glass. And it's like, wow, that is cool.
Maybe do you not only touch the tank a million times, but you touch each bottle.
Yeah, you literally, yeah.
Well, maybe it's
one on one with the bottle.
It's all that skin contact you're getting. I'm telling you.
Well, thanks for sharing that story.
Absolutely.
I want to make sure
good prompt.
Heard good. That, and certainly we encourage everyone when you come visit to grab a bottle of that. It's only available here at the winery, right? Yeah,
that's correct.
Yep.
And online, you can get it online.
Okay.
So speaking of coming to visit it online, so tell us, how can customers find you?
We are at www.parkerbinsvineyard.com. That's all one word. We're Parker Binns Vineyard on Facebook, Instagram. We don't use Twitter. Not to say that you shouldn't, but we just have not. And then I would encourage anybody that goes to our website to check out our events tab. We have our pig picking coming up here at the end of April, the 22nd. And that's it's our big party of the year, if you will, an all-day music festival, so to speak. I'll roast one or two
whole hogs,
and then we'll do a bunch of smoked pork butts, barbecue sauce competition. We'll have a ton of vendors at the site. It's an all-day affair. We have people camping the night before, the night of, and then sometimes the night after. And then absolutely. And then, you know, events are a mainstay, definitely something we pride ourselves in here. So we try to throw a fun event as we try to be the fun vineyard. So check that out for sure.
And physically, you're located where?
2275 Whitesides Road here in Mill Spring, North Carolina. So we're about 5 minutes away from the Tryon International Equestrian Center.
And that's right off of US 74. That's, so it's an easy drive from Charlotte, Asheville, Hendersonville,
that's right,
Greenville, Spartanburg, wherever you're listening.
It's a good center.
Well, I just came down from Asheville. It took me 48 minutes. It takes me about the same thing to get to Greenville, about 30 to get to Spartanburg, and about an hour and 10 minutes to get to Charlotte.
Yeah.
So good location and easy accessibility.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, this has been fantastic. And third time is a charm.
It's been
tried
fun.
Three yes. times. This yeah. is the third time we tried to do this interview. We're so glad Bob's here to join us. We're glad Karen made a guest appearance as well. Thank you. And we look forward to coming back again soon.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
That's it for this episode of Cork Talk.
Thanks again to Bob, Corey, Justin, and our special guest, Karen. We are very grateful that they were able to host us for the conversation, and we highly recommend you plan to visit.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and a review. It helps others find Cork Talk and lets us know how we can improve.
And don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at NC Wine Guides.
Until next time, and remember, the cork only talks when it's out of the bottle. Cheers!
Cork Talk is a free run LLC production.
This episode was made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council.